Judge Jeremy D. Fogel from the United States District Court for the Northern District of California, sitting by designation of the Chief Justice. We appreciate his assistance. Our first case this morning is 071112, American Seating v. USSC. Mr. Dickinson?
May it please the court, the jury in this case awarded American Seating lost profit damages for passenger seats that are normally sold together with a patented wheelchair securement system based upon the patented ARM diagram. The jury did so after being properly instructed on the right height standard, and they did so based upon substantial evidence showing that, one, there is a functional relationship between the patented ARM tie-down and the passenger seats, and two, the patented ARM tie-down was the basis for customer demand for the passenger seats.
Let me make sure I understand the exact scope of what the jury awarded. Were these, in these buses where there's a tie-down, there's often a flip-up seat that's in the same area as the tie-down.
Correct.
Now, was this award for only the one flip-up seat or for the entire set of seats in the bus?
All the passenger seats, including what we call fixed seats as well as flip-up seats.
Okay, that's what I thought. I just wanted to make sure.
There is a functional relationship because the patented ARM tie-down cooperates with passenger seats on a city bus to facilitate the dual use of wheelchair securement area for either accommodating wheelchair passengers or ambulatory passengers. This is a functional relationship that is described in the summary of the invention of the 038 patent at A143 of the appendix.
Well, again, going back to my first question, I could see an argument that there's a functional relationship between the tie-down and the particular seat that flips up or down right in the area of the tie-down. But how does the tie-down, I suppose the tie-down is in the front of the bus, how does that functionally relate to the seat that's in the back of the bus? You might want to have, for aesthetic reasons, or convenience, or ease of ordering all the seats from one place, all the seats ordered from one company, but I don't see that as a functional relationship.
Well, let me get to that. I'm going to hopefully persuade you that the passenger seats are all of a kind. All the passenger seats need to be related and interchangeable, and that's one of the things that I will show with the visual. And I just want to say before I get to that, that the ADA mandates that these city buses accommodate both wheelchair and ambulatory passengers, and therefore, from the standpoint of the bus builders and transit authorities, the patented ARM tie-down serves no useful purpose and has no commercial value without passenger seats to outfit an ADA-compliant city bus. Therefore, the seats in the securement are analogous to components of a single assembly, and to address your question further, I think it will be helpful if we look at the securement area, and I'm going to try to relate that as well to the seats outside the securement area. A474 and A475 in the appendix are photographs of the skid-mounted mock-up of the ARM tie-down area that was brought into the courtroom and demonstrated to the jury by Dave McLaughlin. This was trial exhibit 8. The district court said in its JMOL ruling that McLaughlin's demonstration did not include passenger seats. However, the transcript of what McLaughlin actually said during the demonstration at A255 in the appendix suggests otherwise. In any event, it is beyond dispute that McLaughlin referred to the ARM training video that was shown to the jury, which is A490 in the CD in the appendix. And that video plainly shows the operation of the passenger flip seats in conjunction with the securement of a wheelchair passenger using the ARM. I've taken that training video and blown up two video stills from the video at about 1 minute 45 seconds of running time For the top image that you see back here in about 1 minute 55 seconds for the bottom image. Well, what I think this shows is, first of all, that this is the flip seat in the down position, this is the flip seat in the up position. This diagonal line here is the lap belt that is secured, that secures the wheelchair passenger in his wheelchair when the wheelchair itself is tied down. Notice how this is the ARM down here. Notice how when the ARM is retracted in its stored position and the seat is folded down, the seat actually serves as a guard or cover so that the ARM on the floor there is a tripping hazard for passengers. Now, with respect to the connection between fixed and flip-up seats, the court in this question acknowledged that one function here is an integrated matching appearance. These flip seats, this is a section of fixed seats here, share a common appearance. But also notice this line here, this is an armrest. When this armrest is on the fixed seat and it operates to prevent passengers sitting on the flip seat from sliding forward off the seat in the event of a sudden stop by the bus. This is a requirement that is specifically required in the specifications of the Los Angeles Transit Authority at 8456, Santa Monica Transit Authority at 8456.
Is there any reason why others can't make the fixed seats the same way?
Well, they I guess it has to do with coordinating and integrating the use on the space of the bus. Yes. Would it be possible for two different seat suppliers to cooperate and coordinate in this way? Perhaps. What the customers want is to make sure that they have one supplier that makes sure that fixed and flip-up work together.
Is that enough? I mean, is customer demand without some functional relationship enough to get you the convoyed sales?
I think you need the functional relationship.
So is there a functional relationship other than common appearance?
I think that the armrest, which is a part of the fixed seat, it has to be there. It can't be on the flip-up seat. So this is providing a function. The armrest on the fixed seat provides a function relative to the passengers on the flip-up seat.
But
specifically called on.
But that's not patented, is it?
No.
That's what I'm not asking the question right, but I'm wondering why anybody who makes seats can't just provide those fixed seats without violating anybody's patent.
Well, they can't.
Yeah. Other than the fact that they don't look right. Maybe they won't look exactly the same and aesthetically, but functionally, they'll be the same.
Well,
maybe you could get to the precisely what is the functional relationship. I think we've been asking in a different way. What precisely is the functional relationship that ties those with the tied out?
The fixed seats.
Right.
I think you have to say that the tie down has a functional relationship with a flip seat. And the flip seat is related functionally to the fixed seats. One of they share a common component, which I'm holding in my hand, which is this insert here. This is a removable piece that is designed to be interchangeable. American Seating has this feature. USSC had this feature. This is touted in the USSC sales brochure for the Aries seat, which promotes the sale of both fixed and flip-up seats. These are interchangeable between fixed and flip-up, and this facilitates the customers keeping one stockpile of replaceable inserts. These things are designed to be easily removable because the seating surfaces become worn and soiled and need to be replaced. Okay.
Well, you're into your rebuttal time. Would you like to save it?
I just want to say that the That brochure also demonstrates that a selling point of the Aries seat by USSC is a selling point. It touts the VPRO securement system as a selling point for this seat. And the testimony of David Laughlin, Christian Hammershaw, David Kiernan, Dennis Howard, all established that customer demand for the ARM, or the wheelchair security.
Well, you're repeating yourself now. There's a limited amount of time. Yes, Mr. Gaffin?
Morning. The most telling evidence which demonstrates that the fixed seats and the restraint at issue do not have a functional relationship is Mr. McLaughlin's own courtroom demonstration, Appendix 474, that showed that the restraint works perfectly fine, that's the video, perfectly fine without the fixed seats. That alone demonstrates no functional relationship. An American seating can't run, and it can't hide from that demonstration. And to solidify or confirm that, all you have to do is look at what Mr. McLaughlin, American Seating's vice president who did the demonstration, said at page A328 of the appendix. He agreed that to make the restraint work, you don't need the fixed passenger seats. Don't need to get very much more into the record to determine that there's absolutely no functional relationship between the restraints and the fixed seats in the bus. So when the trial court granted the post-trial motion and reduced the jury verdict, it acted properly. There was no substantial evidence to support the verdict that the fixed seats were a convoyed sale of the restraint system.
Now the restraint system, again, to make sure that I understand
sure.
where the line is drawn here between what was considered to be within the award of the proper award of damages and what was not. The restraint system included the flip-up seats or
the
not?
The restraint system included the barrier. The restraint system did not include the flip-up seats. We asked the trial judge to separate flip and fixed seats, and he refused. And he let it go to the jury. But American Seating didn't apportion or separate that out either.
Okay, so the award here was cut back so that it included only the restraint system and not the flip-up seats? In other words, what the judge excluded, to ask the question more clearly, was not just the fixed seats, but also whatever damages would be associated with the flip-up seats?
I think so, because American Seating wasn't clear in how it apportioned the calculation of damages between restraint. Restraint and barrier were included. Whether the flip seats were on the restraint side or on the fixed seat side is not clear from their proofs, which is a failure of proof on their part. Another reason the award has problems.
But it was
clear that the majority of the convoyed sales were the fixed seats in the back of the bus.
But I have the same question Judge
sure.
Bryson does. The convoyed sales were all of these seats, both the flip seats and the passenger seats, as far as we can tell.
I believe that's how American Seating attempted to prove its damage claim. But going back to the fundamental question of functional relationship, which is the legal test in right height, there simply is none. The restraint works perfectly fine without all those fixed seats in the back of the bus. The evidence is overwhelming in that regard. You have not only American Seating's admissions and demonstration, you have evidence that customers bought seats and restraints from two different suppliers, including the inventor, Mr. Ditch. His own transit authority bought seats and restraints from two different suppliers. And if the only way the American Seating restraint works is to have the American Seating fixed seats in place, American Seating's got a problem. That alone undermines its argument. Two, the customers acknowledged no functional relationship. Mr. Merced, from one of the transit authorities at Appendix 246, agreed that you don't need the fixed seats to make the restraint work. Right from the horse's mouth, the user. Three, the patent itself is silent about the need for the fixed seats in the bus to make the restraint work. There's nothing in the specification about that. Four, you have testimony from customers, Mr. Merced and Mr. Ditch, that while it's convenient to buy from one source, that the convenience, customer demand, business advantage, marketing advantage is not the test. I think Wright-Hite lays that out fairly clearly, and I think that's the appropriate test. What I think American Seating is trying to do is make this leap of logic that if the restraint and the flip seats have some functional relationship, and then if the flip seats and the fixed seats have some relationship, ergo, the restraint and the fixed seats have a relationship. That's not the legal test, that leap of logic that doesn't fly here. Wright-Hite requires a functional relationship. It requires a sale, and it discards arguments that convenience, business advantage get you there. And American Seating's attempted reliance on paper converting doesn't get there. Paper converting was a case that is, I think, limited by Wright-Hite. Wright-Hite specifically says that sales for convenience, business advantage, marketing advantage simply don't meet the legal requirement here. Same with Juicy Whip. We see this argument on aesthetics or appearance. Well, in Juicy Whip, appearance is part of the patent. Syrup needs a dispenser. Dispenser needs to dispense something. Much closer relationship. Here, it's aesthetics. And in fact, you can go on buses in this very city, on the circulator, and see seats that look different. I think the end and the simple answer is American Seating simply didn't meet its burden of showing the functional relationship required by the case law. The jury got it wrong. The trial judge got it right. He sat there, he listened to the evidence, he saw the courtroom demonstration, and his grant of judgment as a matter of law on that issue was proper, and his reduction of the jury award was proper and should be affirmed. I want to move to our cross appeal. The trial judge didn't get everything right, but most of it. We have two issues on our cross appeal. One, the argument that American Seating is entitled to damages for sales of the non-infringing V-Pro 2 restraint system made by the defendant based on an argument that the defendant first offered an infringing V-Pro 1 device and then switch the customer to the non-infringing device. That argument is not supported by the trial record. When you look at the record evidence very carefully, you'll have to conclude that American Seating did not meet the burden it had to put into evidence facts which support the contention that USSE first offered a V-Pro 1 for sale. We're going to ask this panel to reverse the trial court's refusal to grant judgment as a matter of law on that issue. What is a trial record? There are only five sales at issue here. Austin, the Southeast Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Jacksonville, and Contra Costa, CCCTA, I think it is. 824 units. And those sales also included, the award originally included convoy sales, which have been stricken by the trial judge. Only two other quotes are in evidence for those five sales. And those two quotes offer for sale a V-Pro. But at the time those quotes were made, both the V-Pro 1 and V-Pro 2 were available for sale, V-Pro 2 being a non-infringing device. There could be no inference that that referred to the V-Pro 1 when the V-Pro 2 was available, and there's no record evidence to clarify that in that regard, except for one thing. American Seating did introduce an email, I think it's Exhibit 8, Appendix 636 through 637, from USSE's engineering director, or sales director. That's what American Seating relies on, that the only evidence they have that they can use to rely upon to say that there's a V-Pro 1 offered for sale.
Don't they also have a customer who said that they didn't want the V-Pro 2?
Interesting. Mr. Peterson from American Seating testified that Los Angeles didn't want the V-Pro 2. However, the record evidence that American Seating later put in showed that Los Angeles, in fact, took the V-Pro 2. That evidence goes no more than saying the customer was concerned, but apparently the concerns were overcome because the customer eventually bought the V-Pro 2. That evidence doesn't prove anything, at least in terms of the reluctance to switch. The second big, that's one of the two big contracts here, Los Angeles. The other is South Philadelphia, SEPTA. With respect to the South Philadelphia project, the email that American Seating relies so heavily upon to make this argument specifically says that the customer accepted the change. And it's our contention that when the customer knowingly decides to take the different non-infringing product, that cuts off causation. Customer choice, new sale, no causation.
Even if you got your foot in the door with the infringing device, which, let's say, by hypothesis, you never would have gotten to the customer. The customer is very interested in the infringing device. You sit down with the customer, and then you're just about to conclude the contract, and you say, well, actually, we're going to offer something, an upgrade, which, in fact, is the non-infringing device, a bait and switch, to use the
plaintiff's term.
Common parlance. You think there's no basis, even on those facts, for concluding that a damage award would be appropriate in that situation. I recognize you don't say that, you don't think that's this case, but in the proposition that you've laid out for us would include that case. That is to say, where the customer ultimately agrees to the second product, cuts off all damages. Would you think that that would apply even in my case?
I would say yes. I mm-hmm. think that when the customer makes a knowing choice to take a different product, mm-hmm. that can't be an infringing sale. We asked the trial judge to make that change in the jury instruction, and the trial judge refused. But I do think that when the customer gets to make the choice, decide between the two products, decides the upgrade is the product at once, that cuts off causation. But on this record, it's paltry. American Seating simply didn't put in the evidence that it needed to put in. It saw no testimony from the customers. Again, it's only a handful of customers and two big projects. Perhaps the better course of action was to bring Los Angeles or Philadelphia in to hear from the horse's mouth, and we didn't hear that, and to rely upon inferences and quotes that are ambiguous because the VPRO 1 and VPRO 2 were both available and both sold to those customers. It isn't the kind of record evidence that supports the jury verdict in it on that issue. The second issue we have on our cross appeal is the public use issue. On this issue, I think the key element is to determine whether amongst and between all the players involved here, Mr. Ditch, an employee of the Transit Authority, Mr. Razavi, a vendor to the same Transit Authority, and the employees of both companies, and some outsiders who saw this invention demonstrated. And there's no dispute here that it was demonstrated in 1994. Mr. Ditch said it had all the elements contained in the patent. There's no experimental use argument. Do those people all have a duty to keep this a secret to each other? And the answer is no. How could employees of a company owned by the vendor have the duty to either Long Beach or Mr. Ditch to keep that a secret in the absence of any agreement with them? There's no record evidence to say they agreed to keep it a secret. They're just argument. Mr. Ditch is wearing two hats. He's wearing the hat of Long Beach when it's convenient to keep it a secret, and he's wearing his own hat when he wants to exploit and commercialize this invention. He can't have it both ways. The disclosure to the ultimate customer at the beginning is a public disclosure without any aura of confidentiality. I'm into my rebuttal time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Dickinson?
Yes, sir. With respect to the convoyed sales argument, McLaughlin testimony goes to simply the mechanical operation of the ARM and does not go to the function of the wheelchair restraint system from the standpoint of the end user and the customers that buy it, which is to completely outfit a city bus that complies with the ADA. With respect to the fixed and the flip-up seat relationship, I think that there is the uniformity of appearance is an aesthetic aesthetic function that was demanded by the customers. There's no evidence in the record that any customer ever bought fixed seats and flip-up seats from separate suppliers. With respect to the VPRO 2 sales, the majority of these sales were to Los Angeles and SEPTA, and I think the evidence is clear. First of all, conceded by counsel for USSC, not in the presence of the jury, but on the record of the trial court, that there was this, that there were V-Pro 2 sold, delivered to customers who had originally purchased on the basis of an offer to sell V-Pro 1. The only question is, how do we identify these? We're handicapped by the fact that this March 16, 2004 memo shows up less than a week before trial. I think that alone is pretty persuasive evidence, and if that's not enough, I think all you have to do is look at the evidence that USSC cites in the subsequent correspondence by email between USSC and SEPTA, which is found in the appendix at A637 and A638, which I believe goes through May. SEPTA and USSC are still talking about this switchover, and the discussion is about can we go ahead and make the switchover without getting the approval of SEPTA? Should we go back and retrofit 100 buses that have already been delivered with the V-Pro 1? I think that is clear. SEPTA ended up with V-Pro 2 based on the offer to sell V-Pro 1. Mr. Gaffin contends that LA also. LA was a job that was sold in 2001 before V-Pro 2 was even on the market. There were substantial deliveries of V-Pro 1. Then they started getting V-Pro 2, and Michael Chang told Mr. Klotz from USSC that he had some serious reservations about that. Mr. Gaffin contends that, well, if the customer ultimately gives his blessing to it, then it's okay. That, I think, is what the Stryker versus Intermedics case says, that you're not competing on a level playing field if you get the job in the door based upon offering an infringing product and then try to avoid liability for infringement by substituting a that does not infringe. Mr. McLaughlin made his best estimate based upon not only the evidence in the record, but the discovery documents that had been produced to him by USSC showing the timing of the deliveries of these jobs, and he came to the conclusion that there were five where the customer had initially taken V-Pro 1 and then got V-Pro 2. USSC never came forward to show, no, these customers were offered a V-Pro 2. The attempts at Christian Hammarskjöld to explain how they got these jobs was so conflicting and confusing that I think the jury was within its province to completely disregard that and say, if USSC has some reason for convincing us that McLaughlin was wrong, that why aren't they coming forward to it? Well, they certainly have the ability to show what this customer was offered. They never made any type of coherent showing that these five customers were offered a V-Pro 2 before the sale was made.
Was the jury specifically instructed about this theory of damages?
Yes.
The substitution theory?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And what exactly were they told? Well, that's all right. I'll find it. I don't want to cut it to your time.
I can give you the citation to the jury instruction. What they're basically told is that if you find that, and it's in the jury verdict as well, if you find that customers bought V-Pro 2, or sales of V-Pro 2 were made based upon infringing offers to sell V-Pro 1.
It's a but-for argument, right, that they wouldn't have bought the V-Pro 2 if it hadn't been for the V-Pro 1 offer.
Yes.
Okay, thanks. That's what I was looking for.
Well, thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Gaffin.
First, to answer Judge Bryson's question, A79 of the appendix in the court's post-trial opinion, the court recites all the jury instructions, and
right.
The jury instruction on the switch argument is contained there on page A79.
Right. Okay.
This foot in the door argument is interesting because, with respect to these customers, USSC was already doing business. It had its foot in the door selling bus seats. So I think that's telling in terms of the argument that, well, you had to offer the infringing restraint device to get your foot in the door. USSC was already there selling a product. Two, the McLaughlin testimony about the meaning of this email is not the kind of sound economic proof required to prove damages, which the case law says you have to have. It's his opinion about the meaning of a third-party email. And it's American Seating's burden to prove damages, and they didn't get there. To criticize USSC for not making a better record when American Seating failed, that's a big risk to a trial lawyer to make the other side's case for it.
Now, you don't, I take it, have a problem with the language used in the jury instruction?
The language we asked the trial judge to add was that if the customer agreed to make the change, that took it out of that. We asked the court to add that language.
Right. And did you object to the instruction based on the failure to include that?
It was a customer choice issue.
Okay.
Three, Stryker. Stryker was a kit, and the infringement occurred because whether you included the guard or not, or the sleeve or not, when you did the operation, these are separate components that are being sold. This wasn't a kit. I think Stryker is distinguishable on its facts.
All right.
Thank you
very much. The case is submitted.